Welcome back to the deep dive. I hope you're ready to roll up your sleeves today because we are stepping into a virtual study of sorts.
Okay.
Picture a room with walls lined with dusty ledgers, a desk just overflowing with charts, maybe a ticker tape machine clicking away furiously in the corner.
I like it. We're going into the engine room.
We're going into the engine room of the economy, specifically the machinery of government money.
It is a complex machine, for sure, and one that I think dictates the rhythm of our daily lives more than we probably even realize.
Exactly. And for most of us, myself included, we interact with this machine in very specific and usually painful moments. You know, you look at your pay stub and see the taxes taken out, or you turn on the news and hear someone screaming about the national debt hitting a new trillion-dollar milestone.
Right.
But do we actually understand the mechanics of it all? Is it just this black hole where money goes to die, or is there actually a method to the madness?
Oh, there's absolutely a method. It might not always be perfect, and it certainly isn't always pretty, but there is a logic to it.
So to help us decode this, we are diving into a pretty dense academic source today.
Yeah, this one's a heavy hitter.
It's a text simply titled Chapter 15, Government and Public Policies, Focused on the U.S. and Developed Economies. And our mission today is to just strip away the jargon. We're going to talk fiscal policy, debt sustainability, and something called the Ramsey problem.
Which I promise is more interesting than it sounds.
It better
It
be,
really is. It's
Renee.
actually quite provocative. And to, navigate this, I think we should frame the conversation around three really fundamental questions that the source material tackles.
Okay, what are
First, why does the government intervene in the economy at all?
they?
Why not just let the market handle everything? Second, the big scary one, how much debt is too much?
The question on everyone's mind.
And third, what is the actual cost of taxation beyond just the dollars leaving your wallet?
I love that framework. Let's start with the why. Because if you talk to some people, the government is just in the way. But this text lays out three specific pillars for why the government has to step in.
Right. So the baseline in economics is usually that competitive markets are efficient.
Okay.
They allocate resources well. If you want an apple, and I have an apple, we find a price. We're both happy. But that logic, it kind of falls apart in a few specific scenarios. The first pillar is public goods.
Public goods.
These are things that, if the market produced them, they couldn't stop people from using them for free.
Like national defense, that's the classic
Oh,
one.
that is the classic one. You can't protect just the people who subscribe to the Army Premium Plan and leave their neighbors undefended.
Right, the free rider problem.
Precisely. Since a private company can't charge you for it efficiently, they just won't produce it. So the market fails. The government has to step in, tax everyone, and fund it collectively.
Okay, that makes sense. What's the second pillar?
The second is externalities and market failures. This is where a transaction between two people affects a third person, either, positively or negatively, and the price doesn't reflect that.
And the source material used a specific example here that I thought was really clear. Vaccinations.
Yes, it's the perfect example. If I pay to get vaccinated, obviously, I benefit. I don't get sick. But my neighbor also benefits because I'm less likely to infect them.
That's a positive externality.
It is. But when I'm at the pharmacy deciding whether to pay for the shot, I'm probably not thinking about my neighbor.
No, you're thinking about you.
Exactly. The market price only accounts for my benefit, not the societal benefit. So left to the free market, fewer people will get vaccinated than is, socially optimal. The government steps in to fix that.
Right. And then under that same umbrella, they talk about market incompleteness, which sounds like a store running out of inventory, but I know that's not what it is.
No, it's about insurance markets, mostly. There are risks that private companies just won't insure. Unemployment is the big one.
Right.
A private insurer won't sell you unemployment insurance because the people most likely to buy it are the ones who think they're about to get fired.
Adverse selection. The insurer would go broke immediately.
Immediately. So the government acts as the insurer of last resort. We saw this on a massive scale in 2008, which the text talks about. The government bailed out banks because the private market was just broken.
So we have public goods market failures. That brings us to the third pillar, which feels like the most controversial one, redistribution.
It is, but the economic rationale is pretty straightforward. Market
Yeah.
economies can be very efficient, but they are completely blind to fairness. They just naturally generate inequality.
But society cares about fairness.
Exactly. So the government intervenes to, tax the rich and transfer to the poor to create a more equitable allocation. And the text makes an interesting point here, mentioning figure 15.1.
Right. It shows that societies essentially choose where they want to sit on a spectrum.
Yes. You have this trade-off between the benefits of equality, so high taxes funding lots of services, and the efficiency costs of those taxes. Some countries choose one way, others choose another. It's a preference.
Speaking of the U.S., let's talk about how the money is actually being spent. Because the source material points out that the government checkbook looks very, very different today than it did in, say, 1929.
Drastically different. If you look at the historical data, specifically figure 15.2, both revenue and spending were tiny relative to the economy in 1929. They trended upward until about 1970 and then stabilized. But here's a key trend. Expenditures almost always exceed revenues.
So deficits aren't some new crisis. They're the norm.
They are the standard operating procedure. Between 1970 and 2021, U.S. expenditures averaged 34% of GDP, while revenues were only 28%. We were almost always spending more than we bring in.
And looking at those charts, you see these massive spikes.
War and recession. You see a huge jump during World War II, obviously. But then you see these other spikes, 2008, the COVID-19 pandemic. The government acts like a shock absorber. When things go wrong, spending just explodes.
But what are we buying? I think there's a misconception that it's all tanks and aircraft carriers.
Well, that used to be true. In 1959, defense spending peaked at about 8% of GDP. It was the big item.
And today?
It's fallen to around 3%. The real heavy hitters now are healthcare and what the text calls income security.
Income security being things like Social Security and unemployment benefits.
Exactly. Healthcare is over 8% of GDP now. And income security is around 7%. The text calls these programs automatic stabilizers.
I really like that term. It implies the machine kind of fixes itself.
In a way, yeah. Think about unemployment insurance. When the economy crashes, unemployment goes up.
Right.
Which means government spending on those benefits automatically goes up.
Without Congress having to pass a new bill or anything.
Right. And at the same time, because people are earning less, tax revenue automatically goes down. This increases the deficit, which pumps money into the economy right when it needs it most. The machine is built to rev up when the economy slows down.
Okay, so the machine is running, it's spending on healthcare and stabilizers, and it's running a deficit to do it. This brings us to the question that keeps people up at night, the debt. The U.S. debt is around 100% of GDP. Common sense says, I can't do that. Can the U.S. keep doing this forever?
This is where we get into what I think is the most fascinating and counterintuitive part of the whole chapter. There is a specific arithmetic to debt sustainability, and it all comes down to the relationship between two variables, tree and amino.
Okay, let's unpack this carefully. What are tree and gamma?
So tree amino is the real interest rate the government pays on its debt, and gamma is the real growth rate of the economy.
Interest rate versus growth rate. Got it.
So here is the aha moment. If the economy grows faster than the interest rate on the debt, so green debt is greater than tree dollars.
Okay.
The government can actually run a primary deficit forever, and the debt-to-GDP ratio won't rise.
Wait, really? So as long as the whole pie is getting bigger faster than the interest bill, we can just keep borrowing?
In theory, yes. The absolute number of dollars of debt grows, but because the economy is growing even faster, the debt becomes a smaller percentage of the total economy. It feels like magic, but it's just math. You're essentially growing your way out of the debt.
So what are the numbers right now? Or at least, what were they when this text was written?
The text uses data from September 2023. At that point, real GDP growth, gamma de Braz, was averaged at about 3%. The real interest rate, $3, was about 2%.
So 3% growth beats 2% interest. We're in the clear.
Well, not quite. The math says that with those numbers, a primary deficit of about 1% of GDP is sustainable.
Okay, 1% keeps the debt stable.
Right. And what was the actual deficit in 2022?
Let me guess. It wasn't 1%.
It was 3.6% of GDP.
Ah. So we are spending over three times more than the magic formula allows.
Exactly. Even though the growth conditions are favorable, we are still borrowing too much to keep things stable. And there's a huge warning here.
What's that?
This relationship isn't guaranteed. If debt gets too high, investors get nervous. They might demand higher interest rates to hold that debt.
So $2 goes up.
Right. And if $2 jumps up and becomes higher than gamma, the whole equation flips.
Oh.
Suddenly, the interest is compounding faster than the economy is growing. You can't run deficits anymore. You have to run surpluses, meaning tax hikes or spending cuts, just to stop the debt from exploding.
Which would be a massive shock to the system.
A very painful one. And that transitions us perfectly to the other side of the ledger. We've talked about spending. Now we have to talk about how we pay for it. Taxation.
And this isn't just about the money leaving your bank account. The text talks about the hidden cost of taxation.
Yes. Economists call this distortion. When you tax something, you change people's behavior. If you tax labor income, you change the incentive to work.
The text mentioned two effects there, the substitution and income effects.
Right. The substitution effect is simple. If the government takes a bigger chunk of your hourly wage, leisure looks cheaper by comparison, so you might, you know, work less.
Why take that overtime shift if the government's taking half?
Exactly. But then there's the income effect. Because the tax makes you poorer, you might have to work more just to maintain your standard of living. So it's a tug of war. But this also applies to capital taxes. Taxes on savings, dividends, corporate profits.
What's playing that one?
If you tax the return on saving, people save less. If people save less, there's less capital for companies to invest in machines and technology. And if companies invest less, workers have less efficient tools and their wages can eventually stagnate.
So taxing a rich person's investment portfolio today might actually lower a factory worker's wage in the future.
According to the standard growth models in the text, yes. It reduces the capital stock of the entire nation over the long run.
We can't talk about taxes without mentioning the famous Laffer curve. It came up in the text.
It did. It gets politicized a lot, but the math is simple. If the tax rate is 0%, the government gets zero revenue.
Makes sense.
But if the tax rate is 100%, the government takes every penny you earn. Well, nobody's going to work. So the government also gets zero revenue.
So the curve goes up and then comes back down.
Exactly. It's hump-shaped. The peak revenue is somewhere in the middle. The big debate is always about where that peak is. But the takeaway is you can't just raise taxes indefinitely and expect revenue to keep climbing.
Okay, so if taxes distort behavior, what's the best way to tax? The text walks through a thought experiment called the Ramsey problem.
This is one of the most influential ideas in public finance, it asks. If we could design a tax system from scratch to maximize everyone's well-being, what would it look like?
And the answer was surprising.
Very. Ramsey's solution has two main parts. First, you should tax labor at a constant rate over time. Don't jack taxes up during a war and drop them in peacetime. Smooth it out.
Okay, tax smoothing. I can get behind that. What's the second part?
The second part is the shocker. Ideally, the tax on capital income, on savings, on investments should be zero.
Zero. So workers pay taxes on their wages, but investors pay nothing on their profits. That sounds wildly unfair.
It sounds terrible from an equity standpoint, I get it. But the economic logic is all about the long game. The argument is that taxing capital distorts the decision to save, and that distortion compounds over time.
I see.
If you stop taxing capital, people save more. That savings fuels massive investment. The economy gets so much bigger and wages rise so much that even the workers are better off in the long run.
A smaller slice of a much, much bigger pie.
That's the idea. But, and there's a huge but here, there is a flaw in this plan. It's called the time inconsistency problem.
This sounded to me like a trust issue.
It is entirely a trust issue. Imagine the government promises, if you build a factory, we will never tax it. So you believe them. You build a factory.
And once that factory is built, it's stuck. It can't run away.
Exactly. And the government looks at it and says, that's a nice big pile of money you have there. The temptation to break its promise and tax that capital is overwhelming. It's free money for the government.
But investors know this. They know the government is tempted.
Right. They anticipate that the government will flip-flop. So they just don't build a factory in the first place. Or they don't save as much.
So because the optimal policy zero tax isn't credible, we end up in a suboptimal situation where investment stays lower.
That is the tragedy. It's not about the math. It's about whether you can trust the institution to bind its own hands.
Let's pivot back to debt for a second. We talked about the official debt being around 100% of GDP. But the text drops a bombshell figure later on. It says that's not the whole story.
No, not even close. That 100% figure is just the bonds the government has sold.
Yeah.
But the government has also made promises, specifically Social Security and pension promises. If you calculate the implicit debt.
The what now?
Implicit debt. The present value of all those future promises minus the future taxes we expect to collect. The number is staggering.
Okay, what is the number?
Based on the 2023 data cited in the text, the U.S. federal implicit debt is close to $65.9
trillion. $65.9 trillion. That's almost incomprehensible.
It's about 2.5 times the size of the entire U.S. economy.
How is that even possible? How do we have $65 trillion in off-the-books debt?
Well, it's because systems like Social Security are pay-as-you-go.
Yeah.
The money coming out of my paycheck today isn't going into a vault with my name on it. It's going directly to my grandmother. It's a transfer.
Which works fine if there are lots of workers and few retirees.
Exactly. It works when population growth and productivity growth are high. But we're facing a demographic crisis. The population is aging, and we have secular stagnation, meaning growth has slowed down.
So the math of the system starts to break down.
It does. But here is the key difference between this implicit debt and regular bonds. Bonds are protected by the Constitution, but pension promises, they're political, not contractual.
Meaning Congress can just change the law?
They can raise the retirement age. They can cut benefits. They can increase taxes. The wealth that retirees think they have in Social Security is actually just a political promise. And as that $65 trillion pressure builds, the temptation to change the terms of the deal becomes immense.
That is a very sobering thought.
It is.
Yeah.
And it brings us right back to that trade-off we discussed at the beginning. Efficiency versus redistribution.
Right.
The zero capital tax is efficient, but it feels unfair. The text closes with a look at progressivity in the U.S.
Figure 15.9, right? It shows the U.S. tax system is indeed progressive.
It is. The average tax rate rises as income rises. The rich do pay a higher percentage.
Okay.
And the text models this trade-off explicitly. Higher progressivity, taxing the rich more to give to the poor. It reduces consumption inequality. It creates a fairer society. But consistent with everything we've discussed, it reduces efficiency. It makes people work less.
So there is no perfect solution. There's no magic setting on the machine where everyone is rich and everything is fair.
No, it's a choice.
Yeah.
Society has to choose between a bigger pie efficiency and how evenly that pie is sliced equity. You can't maximize both at the same time.
So let's synthesize this. We've looked at why the government spends public goods, insurance. We've looked at the math of debt that growth must beat interest. We've looked at the hidden danger of that $65.9 trillion in pension promises and the Ramsey trap of taxing capital. What's the big takeaway for you?
For me, it keeps coming back to that time inconsistency problem. It's a profound insight. The best economic policies often rely on the government promising not to do something in the future.
Right. Not to tax capital, not to inflate away debt.
But politicians operate on short election cycles. They are constantly incentivized to break those long-term promises for a short-term win.
So the question is, can we ever truly have an optimal economy if our leaders can't tie their own hands?
Exactly. Unless we have binding rules like constitutional amendments or unbreakable independent institutions, we might always be stuck in a second-best world, simply because we can't trust the future government to stick to the plan.
Well, on that cheerful note, I think we will wrap it up. I want to thank you for guiding us through the machinery today.
My pleasure. Hopefully it wasn't too terrifying.
Just the right amount. And for you listening, next time you look at that pay stub or hear about the debt ceiling, remember, it's not just numbers. It's a massive, complex machine of trade-offs, promises, and a little bit of magical thinking. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.